from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. Fly Me to the Moon. Good Old Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra. Fly Like an Eagle, the Steve Miller Band. I Think I Might Fly Down to Rio, Mike Nesmith. Expecting to Fly, Buffalo Springfield. Sparks Will Fly, the Rolling Stones. There's a Fly in My Soup, Spike Milligan. Oh, how did that get in there? Anyway, what's this all about this week in 30 Laps? Well, we look at 10 interesting features from the world of military aviation that made our humble car safer. Also, GM said last week, or some time ago, they were going to go electric by 2035. So we better get across that too this week. The sparks are flying this week in 30 laps. Without any further ado, let's get on to it, shall we? From the Sydney Morning Herald of the 29th of January this year, by Steve Mafusen, General Motors aiming to eliminate petrol and diesel cars by 2035. General Motors said on Thursday, that was a couple of Thursdays ago, US time, that it will end the sale of all petrol and diesel-powered passenger cars and light sports utility vehicles by 2035, making a historic turning point for the big US-based car maker and a future full of new electric vehicles for the American motorists. GM Chief Executive Mary Barra, who antagonised many climate experts by embracing President, now ex-president, Donald Trump's relaxation of fuel efficiency targets, said the company was eliminating all tailpipe emissions from the light-duty vehicles by that date. As one of the world's largest automakers, we hope to set an example of responsible leadership in a world that is faced with climate change, she said on LinkedIn. A GM executive who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe details of the GM shift said the company would spend US $27 billion, Australian $35.1 billion, on electric vehicles and associated products between 2020 and 2025, outstripping spending on conventional petrol and diesel cars. That figure includes refurbishing factories and investing in battery production in conjunction with LG Chem, a South Korean battery maker. The company also said it would manufacture about 30 types of electric vehicles, about 20 of which will be for sale in the United States. Fred Krupp, president of the Environmental Defense Fund, which had worked with GM on its plan, called it a breakthrough moment. And it's part of a wave of industry action that reinforces what the Biden administration is doing, said Krupp. President Joe Biden detailed a plan to transition the US economy away from oil, gas and coal and towards solar, wind and other clean energy, saying the country must lead the global effort to cut pollution that is driving climate change and speeding the planet towards environmental catastrophe. Biden signed an executive order that calls for the federal fleet of about 645,000 vehicles to be converted to electric power. Biden's plan creates demand and drives down the costs as privately owned fleets will follow suit, Krupp said. Critics said GM left itself room to manoeuvre and still had not publicly joined the four other automakers that agreed to comply with California's fuel efficiency standards, which are more stringent than the federal targets under Trump. The California settlement is an important benchmark in restarting negotiations among auto companies. The California Air Resources Board and the Biden administration over cutting greenhouse gas emissions in the transport sector. GM statement left wiggle room in the continuing internal combustion engines manufacturer, critics noted. The company did not rule out using carbon offsets or credits, if absolutely necessary, to reach its goal of eliminating tailpipe emissions. That means GM could invest in programs that remove carbon dioxide from the air, such as tree planting, and still sell some petrol-powered vehicles. And GM said its plans for decarbonising and transitioning to 100% EVs would take place as supported by our commitment to settling science-based targets. Dan Becker, director of the Safe Climate Transport Campaign at the Centre for Biological Diversity, said, given GM's polluting track record, their promise to arrange some offsets for pollution meant that the company's plan was just blue smoke and mirrors. Yes, folks, I think it will be interesting to see how General Motors do this, and we will be along for the ride, keeping an eye on things. Thanks by Stephen Mufusen, or Mufsen, I beg your pardon, from the Sydney Morning Herald of the 29th of January. Yes, sparks will indeed fly. Thank you for Charlie Watts. He's so easy to spot when he's drumming on a song. Not to mention the bloke up the front who's singing it. Okay, on to Autocar, the online magazine. 10 fascinating ways planes have helped cars get better. This was written on the 14th of January 2021 by Tom Evans. He says, a lot of the technology in our cars today owes its existence to being invented for military and aviation applications. In this story, we analyse all the equipment we take for granted that first began their days doing something rather different. First cab off the rank, anti-lock brakes. Anti-lock brakes are now mandatory on cars produced in the EU and the US, and in Australia as well, I might add. The system was, however, invented by the French aviation pioneer Gabriel Voisin, 1880 to 1973, who first employed the technology in a rudimentary mechanical form in heavy bombers his company produced towards the end of World War I. The aircraft often had to land and stop on short runways close to the front without bursting their tyres. And folks, those early World War bombers were huge. So we moved to anti-lock brakes in cars. ABS is one of the most important safety features on today's road cars. On most surfaces and in most conditions, it will allow your car to stop more quickly, as the system varies the brake pressure at each wheel, preventing lockup. The technology was first employed in a road car in a Jensen FF, a British tour four-wheel drive sports car, in 1966. ABS arrived in various Chrysler models in 1970, while Mercedes-Benz introduced it in a much more sophisticated four-wheel drive multi-channel system on its S-Class W116 in 1978. The heads-up display. Heads-up display, or HUD in aviation speak, started life before World War II, where rudimentary systems added a targeting reticle onto the aircraft bombsite to aid bombing accuracy. Then, during the war, Britain's RAF managed to reflect the radar screens onto the windshield of a Mosquito night fighter aircraft. They became progressively more sophisticated in the post-war years, beaming all sorts of threat indications onto fighter aircraft displays. They are now used in civilian aircraft as well. Huds, H-U-D-S, was first featured on a production car in the Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme convertible Indy 500 pace car, 50 of which were offset to selected, or offered, I beg your pardon, to selected customers in 1988. They became a permanent feature in the Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme sedan as a cost option in 1990. It showed the car's speed in a digital display. GM got the technology from Hughes Electronics, a subsidiary and a remnant of the Howard Hughes aviation empire, which GM purchased in 1985. How about heated glass? Heated glass works by passing electric current through a glass pane covered with an electrically conductive coating. This was widely used on aircraft in World War II to stop the windshields freezing up in low temperatures and at high altitude. In the post-war period, such technology became cheaper. Its usefulness in de-icing car windshields in winter became apparent. Ford first installed a system on various 1974 models in America, but it proved unreliable. It returned to the technology in a more reliable way in the European Ford Granada and the Ford Taurus and the Mercury Sable in 1985. It's now a staple of most Fords and is used by many other companies as well. In fact, your car probably has a heated rear window. Titanium. As a material, titanium is very strong and light and resistant to corrosion and is perfect for the aerospace industry. The metal is a defining ingredient of America's Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird reconnaissance aircraft, which was 92% made from titanium. Most of it was ironically sourced from the Soviet Union, the country the SR-71 was designed to spy on. Nowadays, you won't find titanium being used on mass production models due to its cost, but it has wound its way into premium sports and supercars, such as the Corvette C7, that was fitted with titanium exhausts. In 2015, the Icona supercar was unveiled, billed as the world's first titanium car, yours for $3 million. The V8 engine. The first V8 engine was invented by the French pioneer Léon Levasseur. He was 1863 to 1922. In 1902, and was originally fitted to a aircraft before finding its way into fighter aircraft during World War I. The engine itself was originally designated Antoinette, after the daughter of the financial backer of the project. It was a smart man naming it Antoinette, I think. V8s in cars, of course. Well, the car world wouldn't be the same without the invention of the V8 internal combustion engine. Even in today's downsize age, it can be found in some form or another in many popular sports cars in various states of configuration. And the V8 is still extremely common and mainstream in America, especially in pickups, which are our utes, SUVs and muscle cars, like the Dodge Challenger SRT. Of course, radar. This technology started life under its full name, Radio Detection and Ranging, and was invented by a number of countries in the 1930s, broadly independent of each other, since it was a huge secret. Back then, the entire world was afraid of aerial bombing in much the same way as we're scared of nuclear missiles today. And radar helped to level the playing field, in theory, by giving an early warning of attacking bombers. The first successful application was by the British, which used its Chain Home radar system to detect its fighters against the German Luftwaffe during the Battle of Britain in 1940. Of course, radar in cars. The principle of radar was first used in the car world when Toyota fitted its black sonar equipment into its 1982 Corona, which helped the parking process by emitting a beep, beep when the car approached the car behind. In 1998, radar technology was used by the Mercedes-Benz on the W220 S-Class to give the world its first radar-guided adaptive cruise control system, available in a production car. Additionally, radar is widely used by the police forces and speed cameras to enforce the police forces' limits. Well, the country's limits, which are enforced by the police force. I wonder if his brand new car has got GPS navigation. Getting lost, running out of fuel and crashing is an extremely common way for aircraft to meet their end during and after the Second World War. To help counter this, the United States government started launching a series of satellites to help with global positioning of its aircraft, ships and submarines in the 1950s, a system called Transit. A much more accurate system called Global Positioning System, or GPS, replaced it when it went fully live in 1993. Civilian access of which began in the late 1980s. The Mazda Yunos Cosmo was the first production car to be equipped with GPS-directed sat-nav in 1990. The BMW 7 Series became the first European car with the technology in 1994. And the following year, GM's Oldsmobile became the first American company to feature it in a system called GuideStar. Well, they couldn't call it GPS along with everybody else. I don't know. Anyway, to this day, GPS-enabled equipment operates courtesy of the United States Air Force. Fuel injection. Fuel injection technology greatly improves fuel economy, power output, and reliability. This was first used in the Antoinette V8 aircraft we spoke of earlier. The technology became widespread in fighter plane engines during the Second World War, especially in the German ones like the Messerschmitt Bf 109, which gave them an advantage in high-speed handling. Carbureted engines, as used in aircraft like the British Spitfire, could lose power during certain manoeuvres. That, I would imagine, would give you a bit of a fright if you had a Messerschmitt on your tail. One of the most notable fuel-injected engines was the Daimler-Benz DB601 V12, as used in that Messerschmitt Bf 109. After the war, Daimler had no use for the engine in its former application, but needed a high-performance power plant for a new, glamorous sports car that was meant to symbolise the confident emergence into the post-war age. So, it took the 601's design, chopped in half the cylinder count, and reduced it in size from 33.9 litres to 3 litres, but it still delivered a healthy 243 horsepower. Thus, Mercedes-Benz had the engine for its new 300 SL Gullwing, one of the most famous cars ever made. Unveiled in 1954 at the New York Auto Show, it used mechanical fuel injection, electronic fuel injection, and arrived in various Chrysler-produced vehicles. I beg your pardon. Fuel injection itself arrived first in America in various Chrysler-produced engines in 1958. Turbocharging, now you're talking. Turbocharging forces extra compressed air into an engine's combustion chamber to produce extra power. While first patented back in 1905, it wasn't until 1915 that turbocharging was first fitted to a combustion engine. French engineer Auguste Ratoux installed a turbo on a Renault engine used by the French fighter aircraft during World War I. His ingenious system helped preserve the same level of air pressure in the engine regardless of the aircraft's height, thus preserving its performance in thinner air at altitude. Today, of course, turbochargers are widely used by combustion engines and cars, and because they help produce decent amounts of power from relatively small engines, are a key part in helping improve fuel economy levels. They are also vital for diesel engines whose inherent languidness is significantly neutralised by turbocharging. And there we have it, folks. Tom Evans wrote on the 14th of January 2021, 10 fascinating ways planes have helped cars get better. Interesting little story, I think, that one, from the online publication Autocar. It's time for our weekly, most of the time it's weekly, weird and surprising car facts for our strange days. And this also comes from Autocar magazine from October even, of last year. And what have we got this week? Well, a road-going dodgem. Ta-da! The Wright Craft scooter car was introduced in 1938 as a road-ready version of the fairground dodgem. Wright Craft fitted a 98cc single-cylinder engine, that took the car all the way up to a heady 15 miles an hour. Despite its tiny size and sloth-like performance, Jim Parkinson drove one round the world on a 421-day, 15,000-mile odyssey, as chronicled by Motor Magazine. He didn't even take one of the later models that packed a 250cc engine, and it was good for probably a frightening 40 mile an hour. How about something from Ford? Ford Aerospace. Ford started making aircraft in 1925, and 199 of its three-engine ATE trimotor airliner were built in 1933. Ford was briefly, there's a lot of briefly's going on here, world's largest maker of commercial aircraft. And at the same time, Ford began the world's regularly scheduled commercial cargo airline. Henry Ford gradually lost interest after his personal pilot was killed in a crash flying a Ford prototype monoplane in 1928. And then his company was butted and buffeted by the Great Depression. During World War II, Ford produced the B-24 Liberator bomber under license at its factory in Willow Run in Michigan. In the 1950s, a new Ford division built Sidewinder air-to-air missiles for the US Air Force before Ford sold the business in 1990. I think it's fairly safe to assume that would have been Henry Ford II, not Henry Ford the original, who had long passed on. Talking about producing aircraft, and we spoke earlier in the show about Messerschmitt. Well, after producing thousands of aircraft for Nazi Germany during the Second World War, the firm was forbidden to make any more after it ended for a period of 10 years. It turned its hand to bubble car production instead, and the designs were clearly distant relatives of the firm's aircraft. The micro car market was eventually decimated by the slightly larger, cheap cars like the Mini, and Messerschmitt was allowed back into the aerospace game. Then we've got time for a car chase, haven't we? We've done the weird facts. We're all over the shop today. Let's have a look at a car chase car. And this week it's the Subaru Impreza. And the movie was Baby Driver in 2017. Just as the Subaru Impreza's star was beginning to fade, along comes Baby Driver to introduce the car to a whole new generation. The bright red WRX model steals the show in the opening scenes of the film and is used as a getaway car, and then evades the cops by blending in with the Los Angeles traffic. Stunt driver Jeremy Fry said this is why the Impreza was chosen for the film, because it's an ordinary-looking sedan, but with amazing performance. Several WRX were used for the film, including a couple converted to rear-wheel drive to make it easier to perform some stunts. all came with uprated engine, clutches and a hydraulic handbrake. We'll finish up with a Mercedes 280S from the movie The Driver in 1978. Not so much a chase as a job interview, Ryan O'Neill's character in The Driver has to prove his worth behind the wheel before being taken on as a getaway driver. To do this, he uses a Mercedes-Benz 280S to skid and slide his way around a multi-story car park. As he systematically dismantles the Mercedes, it proves his precision, even though it results in the wreck of the S-Class. Steve McQueen was originally asked to take the lead role, but turned it down. So Ryan O'Neill got to use the racing orange Mercedes. First introduced in 1972, the S-Class has long been one of the world's best and biggest selling luxury cars, and it's now in its sixth generation, and we should see a seventh generation unveiled later in 2020. As a side note, yes, it was unveiled in 2020 with the eighth generation, I think, due early 2022. And that might wrap up the best cars from the best movie car chases. It was written by Al Sutty, and again, it came from Auto Car Online magazine, who's featured very heavily in today's episode. However, it's all been pretty interesting stuff, I think. We've done a couple of weird and surprising car facts. We've done, I think, the last two cars chases from the Al Sutty article. Of course, we've looked at some amazing information and equipment that was first used on aircraft and later put to good use for motor vehicles. So you know where your HUD, if you've got one, your HUD, or your GPS, you know where that comes from now. When next you turn it on, it probably saved some pilot's life in a cold and drafty cockpit in the middle of the war, where it was very noisy and very dangerous. Much like getting a cab home today in the wet. That's just about it from me, I think. This show is written and produced in the Sydney studios of Radio 2RPH. This is Richard Lyon. I've enjoyed myself immensely this afternoon with the great potpourri of information that we've relayed to you. I hope you can join me next week. Until then, stay safe, drive carefully. Bye for now. Mm-hmm.